You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
This was me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody. I'm joined today with my guest, Jeb Graham, managing partner with Metcalf Partners. How are you doing today, Jeb?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Sam?
Doing pretty good. Pretty good. So first, I like to, can you take an opportunity to kind of describe what it is you're working on currently with Metcalf Partners and kind of how that journey's been and how long you've been doing that?
Yeah, I can certainly do that. So Metcalf Partners, it's Metcalf Partners Wealth Management. And I've been, you know, we started the company back in 2013. Well, really, it was 2011 when I jumped into the independent world. And then we actually started branding, you know, as Metcalf Partners back in 2013. But when you think about currently, you know, it's a group here. We're at 130th and Metcalf. You know, when we named ourselves Metcalf Partners, we didn't quite think through the fact that we were going to have to basically be on Metcalf, you know, our office. So this is our third office space on Metcalf in the last 13 years. And, but anyway, yeah, so we're currently working on just doing as good a job as we can for our client base. Our kind of main function for our clients is we're financial advisors, financial planners, and we help people plan for retirement, kind of try to figure out how to take distributions off of the money that they've saved over the years. Those would be our clients that are kind of getting older, getting closer to retirement. We have a lot of clients that are younger that would be, you know, in the beginning of their working life. And we're trying to help them craft a plan of, you know, how much money do you have to save? When do you want to retire? And what do we need to do between now and that point in time to be able to get you to retirement? And then, you know, we also do a fair amount of small company 401k plans or retirement plans for their businesses. So we've got a It's a growing company. It's myself. I've got two partners, Eric Wymore, Ethan Hutchison, who are part of the organization. And then we have a head trader and COO, Andy Voss. We just hired him from another large firm around town about 6 months ago. And then we've got Lynn Henderson, who's our main administrative assistant, Vicky Lovall, who's an administrative assistant. And then we've got a virtual assistant and a virtual marketing person. So we're kind of a small boutique-y group that is experiencing a lot of growth and having a ton of fun while we're doing it. So
that's awesome. Did you think about the branding element when you, it's interesting. I'm thinking about, you know, Microsoft is on one Microsoft way, and, you know, normally the companies name the street after, but you, it sounds like almost strategically, whether you realized it or not, had that branding component even before.
You know, now that you ask that, that's a good question to get a little bit deeper on that. And so the reason that I started, went independent in 2011, and we didn't start branding Metcalf Partners until 2013 is because when I first went independent, I had another partner for a couple of years, and we named the group after our last name. So it was Graham, and then his last name as well. And in 2013, you know, basically we parted ways. And so it was me and one other partner that were still left. And we were like, you know, we got to obviously rebrand because we can't have somebody's last name on the name that's not part of the organization anymore. And our office was at 95th and Metcalf. And we were like, how about Metcalf Partners? You know, it's easy. We're right here. And to me, I joke that we never thought about the fact that we had to stay on Metcalf, but I love the name because I think obviously Metcalf is such a staple in this town as far as it's the biggest street. When you're talking about, you know, Shawnee Mission, Southern Overland Park, it's kind of the main street that comes down. And I think it's symbolic of our city and our town. And I like the name, you know, because I think it really speaks to who we are, which is a local boutique firm that works with a lot of residents of Overland Park, Leawood, you know, Shawnee Mission, Lenexa, and all over Kansas City. So,
So this will be kind of interesting. So I had a partnership breakup that was a little bit, how shall we say? And I know we're kind of, because at some point I want to almost go even earlier, mm-hmm. but what was that? It's just a kind of a high level, and we can go into more detail later. Was that what you would call a difficult breakup?
It was a difficult breakup, a little bit. You know, it was, luckily we were only, whatever it was, a couple of years into it. And so,
yeah.
it was a little bit of a challenge. It wasn't anything like if, you know, you went through something now and we have a much, much bigger business now than we did back then. But yeah, it was a little bit difficult. And it really, you know, at the time, if we're going to dig into that piece of it, and I don't want to go too deep into that, other than, you know, it was our compliance department had a falling out with him, you know, and so when we did that, it was either we all had to leave or he had to leave, and we didn't want to leave, you know, the current RIA that we were part of. And so it was kind of a force split. And I think if you look at where he's at now and where we're at now, it was a blessing in disguise. And I think everybody ended up, you know, where they needed to be. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. So now let's rewind the clock a little bit.
Yeah.
So I like to kind of start the journey right around the high schoolish period, because at least for me, I feel like that's when external influences are at kind of their peak of what is it you want to do when you grow up? What's your career going to be? What's your, you know, some of us are fostering that first dream, and some of us are maybe being told that that first dream is foolish and you should do this other thing. What is going through Jeb's mind at that time, and what kind of was your first dream?
So my first dream, you know, if you go back, obviously before high school, it would have been to be a professional athlete of some sort, like every, or like many, many young kids. And it came pretty clear as I was going through middle school and high school that was not going to be the future of what I was going to do. But I did play athletics. You know, I played basketball and I played tennis and in high school, and I had, in high school, I had a couple of friends who had parents that owned construction companies. And, you know, I don't know exactly. And what's funny is I have zero background. My family has zero background in construction. I have zero background in construction, but it just seemed like, you know, they're building houses around town, and it just, you know, I could tell that they were doing very well financially. And, it was so I, in high school, really thought that, and I thought, you know, you'd own your own business and you'd have a lot of freedom in that, and that sort of thing. And I thought that I wanted to own a construction company. So that was kind of my first, dream. And when I left high school and went to K-State, I actually started, for my first 2 years there in their program that's called Construction Science, which is part of their engineering, school. And, anyway, yeah, so that was kind of my first inclination, was that I was going to try to own a construction company. And, you know, oddly enough, I get into college and I start going through all these classes, like estimating, and then you start going into the science of digging and building foundations and all that stuff. And I was like, you know what? I was in class with a bunch of people that kind of, you could tell, had a background in construction. And I was looking around and I was like, you know, I don't think this is where I'm supposed to be. Didn't feel like it was where I was supposed to be. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't there. I guess I really came to the conclusion really fast. You don't graduate and own a construction company. You actually have to work in construction for a number of years. And I didn't really see that being my path at that point in time. So,
yeah, that interesting. So what, I'm just trying to think of what kind of helped evolve that. Was there something in particular that happened that really triggered that thinking for you? An apex moment of like, this isn't my dream. It was my dream, but it's evolving.
It was my dream.
Now.
And I would say, at that time, if I'm being totally honest, I don't think I really had a dream or much of a direction as to, I just saw people that owned a construction company and it looked like a good life, right? And
yeah.
So I kind of went down that road. So I, to call it a dream, I think would be maybe a little bit brash. It was kind of like, I know I got to start figuring something out. And that's the path that kind of seems like the one for me. And then when I got to school and I was going through classes and all that, I think it might've been when I got to, so you also did, architectural engineering, you know, we had to draft drawings and that sort of thing in a class. And it just wasn't something that was really clicking for me. I think it was like, it was just apparent to me that this was not a strength of mine. And actually what changed when I decided to change it is that I had to take a class called Finance 450, which was the intro to finance class at K-State. And all of the guys in my fraternity and other people that I knew told horror stories about Finance 450 and how hard it was. And I got into that class and it was not hard. I loved the curriculum, first of all. And for me, it came very easy. I got an A. I didn't feel like I had to work real hard for it. And that was where kind of a light bulb went on that, hey, this is, you know, when I was working in construction science, things felt hard. This feels easy and I like it. And this really kind of feels comfortable and something I could see myself doing down the road. So.
No, I know what you mean. We interviewed an accountant that said something very, very similar. She said that, when she was in accounting, it was something that, you know, she looked around and a lot of the class was really kind of struggling and yep. She was kind of nailing the class with minimal effort, so to speak, which yep. is a really interesting thing. So that's when it kind of hits you that it's like, this is more in line yeah. with what I want to do.
Yeah, no, it was number one, I was more interested in it at that point in time. And then it was coming easier to me. And like when you think about the difference between the business school at college and the engineering school, you know, the intensity of it's pretty different. You know, going through the business school is, in my opinion, a little bit more of a fun college experience, a little bit less labor intensive. And it just kind of opened up the world of, hey, not only do I like this, I think my life is going to be a little bit better, easier. Going forward in college, you know, so that was kind of where I decided that I wanted to go down that finance road. And I will say, as I got deeper into the finance curriculum, some of those classes did become more challenging. But when it came to the basics of it, it came pretty easy for me in the beginning. So,
right. So you ultimately ended up graduating then with a finance degree of sorts.
It was, yep. So at K-State. It was business administration with an emphasis in financial services. And there you could do corporate finance or you could do financial services. Financial services, you know, obviously is more in line with what I do today. Yep.
Okay. Now, financial services, though, because that could still be, did they have a focus on like almost kind of wealth advisement or was it almost like a CFO style? Into CPA
so it was more,
style, potentially.
It was more so financial services, which that degree has actually changed. They have a new financial planning degree at K-State, but at that time that I was there, they didn't have that. Financial services was the closest to that. But no, it was more investment management based. So it wasn't really CFO. We did have to go through accounting classes, but it was really focused on, there was a financial planning class that you would take. And then there was a lot of different investment type classes. Then you had to take some econ classes and then the accounting. So, but the focus was really on going into an investment management type role. Yep.
Gotcha. Okay. So then what was your first role having that degree, having that focus on sort of investment management, portfolio management?
Well, so I didn't actually go into my degree until I was 26 years old. Which I guess that's not that old, but it seemed old at the time because I was 4 years out of college. But that would be my first role out of college was actually at Bank of America. So I was underwriting construction loans is what the department that I was in. So it was kind of like I had the finance and the construction piece of it, right?
I was going to say that seems a little... Almost
yeah.
for irony, I don't know.
Yeah, it was
called. Did they know your past, or did you?
No, I kind of ran into it. I actually had a friend from college that worked in. They call it the home builder division, and their whole deal was they financed new subdivisions, new home builds, and that sort of thing. And so it's just so most of the customers were builders, not retail customers. But yeah, so I went in there and I was only there for about 7 months. I think I realized and they realized pretty quickly that that my personality was sitting in a cubicle and I just wasn't it wasn't the fit for me to specifically be on that underwriting side. I think if I would have been on more of a loan officer kind of business development side, it would have been a little bit different story. But yeah, so I went into that, and I got some really good experience of, you know, working in the corporate world and kind of moving out of the college. I would say that I probably right out of college wasn't necessarily mature enough to have a corporate job. So it was that transition period, if you will.
Yeah.
And so, but yeah, so I was there for 7 months, and then I went down the road of, I decided to get my real estate license and be a realtor. And I did that for a year. My aunt was a realtor, and I kind of latched onto her, and I did that for a year. Then, went to work at Sysco Foods as a food sales rep for 2 years. And in that role, basically you're selling food to restaurants, and I had family ties at Sysco as well. And then after a couple of years, you know, that I kind of came to the conclusion that I really wanted to go into what I studied in college, which was becoming a financial advisor and going down the road of investment management. So after a couple of years there, that's when I decided to take my series. I latched up with a big insurance company that had a investment management wing. And from there, I got my Series 7, I got my Series 66, and quit my job at Sysco and kind of started going down the road of where I am at today. So, and I was 26, getting ready to turn 27 years old. I just got married. So I got married when I was 26 years old in June. I quit my job at Sysco, I think in October. And my wife was like, what, you know, I just married you. What are you doing here? You know, you're kind of changing the gate, you know, changing the road here.
Yeah, and the landscape.
There was a little bit of a sales job that I had to do there. To convince her that this was, I
on
felt
the
like
home
this
front.
Was, yeah. Just convince her that I was sure that this was the right transition for the direction I wanted to go. So, yep.
No, that's, there's a couple things you've said that are super relatable. Cause I don't know how well I really did on the first kind of corporate job. I mean, it was an internship, and it was the same sort. What was interesting for me was I was still, I would argue, rather impressionable. And the particular environment I was in, there wasn't a person you'd talk to that didn't outright say they hated their job to somebody who'd just been there for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And so I really couldn't understand why somebody would show up day in and day out, 8 hours a day, for something that they hated to do, right?
Right.
And so, I
mean, that's a big piece of your life right there, right?
I mean, right, he's, right. Yeah. And so my work only got worse and worse and worse, really, before I think they kind of saw me. And it's safe to assume, I'm guessing, so then, I don't know how many people think about this, I definitely don't think about this, but my guess then is, obviously, underwriting is really just taking a lot of the paperwork that the banker has procured, and just, it's probably essentially stacks of that virtually or physically going over and making sure it all checks out in a way that you believe, based on the criteria the bank has provided, that the person is capable of fulfilling the loan.
That's
thus
correct.
That it passes.
Exactly.
So,
yep.
8 hours of sit here, look at, check the boxes.
Right.
And probably get yelled at a decent bit because they need checked at on, I mean, there's a, you know, a lot of folks have a deadline, right, for a project that they need underwritten for.
Yep. Very true. Yeah. All of those things are true. And And that was one of those where it's funny how everybody kind of goes through those jobs, right? Where you go and it's, you kind of have to find out what you don't like to find what is the right fit. And that was one of those experiences for me where it was pretty apparent in the beginning that this was either I needed to find a new avenue there or I needed to find something else to do. So.
Well, and that's part of where I like to phrase it this way, because I think there's a bit of a, I don't even know what to call it. You know, it's like, what are you going to be when you grow up at high school, college, as if anybody really has a clue.
Right.
And so some of us are stressing over something that is going to get switched out three or four times anyway, right?
Well, I will tell you that's what, so I have my oldest daughter who's a junior in high school right now. And she's going through the whole, you know, where she's going to go to college, and we're doing college visits. And right now in her mind, she wants to be, go down the medical track. She wants to be pre-med. And so she's obviously researching schools that have really good pre-medical programs and stuff like that. And my advice to her is just that, you know, when it comes to an undergrad school, I wouldn't pick an undergrad school based on what you think you're going to major in, simply because, you know, every big university has a great biology program that if you do well in and you do well on the MCAT, you can get in med school, right? But there's a really pretty good probability that you might change your major. You might decide to go a different direction once you get there. So I'm really encouraging her just to find a school that she's excited about going to for whatever reason. And then, you know, if she goes pre-med, you know, get a biology degree, go to medical school. And if she decides to change majors, you know, she's at a big university and there's going to be plenty of places, plenty of ways to be able to do that, that they are not feel trapped into anything going into college. So,
well, in perfect world, that's the best environment to experiment, right? You theoretically have these consortium of mentors, coaches, teachers who have hopefully done it or seen enough of it in some facility facet to teach on it, right?
Yeah.
And then so you kind of get to, if you want to, sample these different career opportunities and get an idea of what it's supposed to look like. So you would really hope people would take that opportunity and ultimately change things around before they get a pretty good idea of what it is they're kind of supposed to be doing. You know, yeah, it's actually fascinating too. One of the people we interviewed, I don't even know if it was the college period or something before or after, but he was talking about how he took, it was like a personality test mentorship retreat thing where they basically ended up turning around and saying, this is your personality. This is what you excel at. This is what you would be really good in. And so he almost had out of the box what, and that would, anyway,
yeah.
I don't know where
that's,
I was going with
great,
that.
Yeah, just, that's a great, so basically he at least had some sort of personality inventory and some sort of direction as where to go, yeah.
Right, and it was particularly interesting, right, because it was like he was going to college and he was doing all this stuff, and they basically even told him, they're like, you know, you like structure, but you also like free form, so like outright attorney might be a little bit too stringent, but here's some attorney adjacent related fields that you would really thrive in.
Yep.
And so, yeah, so it makes sense. And I think you're right. I think we all kind of go through the different things that we're not going to like. But I am kind of curious because you correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't feel like the barrier to entry to financial planning, so to speak, is incredibly steep. It doesn't seem like it, at least. So what was kind of the delay in thinking, or was it just, you know, hey, it's the first one, you know, my buddy recommends it, it's a job, I need to get paid, which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
What was the 4-year delay really between that and this is what I want to do? I had a similar delay, by the way.
Yeah. So. You know, and to speak to that, I think a lot of it was immaturity of just not really knowing. I don't think I was ready to enter the workforce right when I graduated college, to be honest with you. You know, I was, some people go to college and they're focused on what they're going to, you know, they're ultra focused on their studies and what they're going to do afterwards. I did well in college, but I will tell you, by the time I got done with college, it took me a while to, I think, realize that I'm not in college anymore, if that makes sense. You know, I was kind of graduated and I was still wanting to live the lifestyle of kind of what college was. And I just hadn't really had an opportunity to sit back and think about what it was that I really wanted to do in life. Like I got the finance degree and that was great, but I always kind of in the back of my mind thought that would be a cool job to be a financial advisor, but I didn't have the commitment level at that point in time to say, hey, I'm going to go all in and do this. And I feel like, you know, people have wake-up calls in life, and I think my big wake-up call was at the end of my Bank of America stint there. It was, you know, because I had actually gotten, worked there for whatever it was, 7 months or so, and then as we parted ways, I had just bought a house. I had two buddies from college that moved in as roommates with me. So I had a mortgage. And it just was one of those things where I kind of felt like it was a failure, right? It was my first job. It wasn't what I wanted to do. It didn't go well, you know, for me. And I think that was like a wake-up call of like, man, this is like, I've now been out of school for close to a year. And I am no closer to having any clue what I want to do with my life than I was a year ago. And now I have a mortgage, and making money's not optional anymore. I got to do it, right? And so I think that was really a time that I started doing some soul searching and kind of trying to figure out where I wanted to go. And what's funny is why I decided to become a realtor was because I had just bought this house, and the guy that was my realtor, Tom Scanlon, I still remember his name. I actually found him in the wanted ads in the Kansas City Star. Like, he basically said, ran an ad that said he was a realtor that knew the Kansas City condo market really well. So I just called him. He was my realtor. He's a super fun guy, and his job seemed fun. You know, he took me around to all these houses, and we were laughing and going through stuff. And I was like, that seems like a fun job. So I'm going to go get my real estate license. And I did that, and I did like that career. However, what I found out with that in real estate was that the pay was very unstable. And this was too. So, by the way, right after I left Bank of America, that would have been July of 2001. So I went and I got my real estate license on a Saturday, and then 9/11 happened the Tuesday. So I passed the test on Saturday. 9/11 happened on Tuesday. Okay, so I had my real estate license literally. The first day that I was allowed to sell houses was not the day of 9/11, because Monday they had to process my license. And so Tuesday was kind of my first day at Keller Williams as a realtor. And what I found being a realtor, just getting started there, is the pay is pretty unstable. And we went into a recessionary period, and there was not a lot of movement in the housing market in, you know, post 9/11. And specifically going into 2002 after that, and we kind of went into that big recession in 02 and 03. And so it was a hard time to get started in real estate. The pay wasn't steady enough. And that's when I, you know, decided to take the corporate job at Cisco and be a sales rep to have a steady paycheck. So Some of that, you know, that delay was kind of financially driven, right? Of like, now I'm going to take another corporate job, make sure I can pay my bills for a couple of years. And then at the end of that couple of years, I got the job in my now profession, and it did have a salary attached to it, even though a lot of it was kind of production based and commission based. It did have a salary for a couple of years, so it gave me that kind of launch pad, and it had good benefits and all that. So it was a great way to get started in the business.
Well, and that's a killer start on the real estate. That first day, I mean, the day when it's supposed to be, you know, bright eyed, bushy tailed. You know, maybe this is the day where we do some of the harder things, but I'm excited about it because it's day one. And, you know, I mean, you're not doing anything that day
or nobody, that week. I remember going in, and everyone was kind of standing around watching the TV.
Yeah.
And that was it. Yeah. So that was a kind of a wild start into that part of my career, for sure.
That's upsetting. It really feels and sounds like, I mean, you're right. Unstable, a lot going on. Difficult, but it also kind of sounds doomed to begin with, right? Because I think we all remember where we were that day, right? It's kind of difficult to forget, frankly. And so to have that be your first day at any new opportunity.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just remember that whole time period being I remember that winter. I don't know if you remember the winter after 9/11, but we had the big ice storm, and the electricity was out for like a week around the city. It was just I remember that being a really long year for me. And I think for a lot of people, right, is that, you know, you had 9/11. I had just kind of started to try this new career. You had 9/11. And then we went through the winter time is slower in real estate anyway. It was just one of those times where I was really trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life and if this was the right path. And because I was excited about it, I was super excited about being a realtor and all that. And I think when I dove into it and I was, you know, I would have one big month and then I'd have a few months where I didn't make any money. And then I was spending a lot of times on the weekends, you know, showing houses. And I felt like it was kind of impeding into my social life a little bit, or just was, it was an unconventional job to a degree.
Yeah. Well, and for an early career option in particular, I feel like that's, I mean, maybe much different for you given your career choice, but, you know, for me and talking to younger folks, it's an interesting, you kind of live, you have this almost paycheck to paycheck mindset, right? Where you're like, you're given money and then we spend that money. And then we live like paupers until the next time we have money, then we spend money. And so for a housing market scenario, right? That's just a wild, obviously that's unsustainable, but if you haven't actively thought about and or been taught, or at least had somebody like, hey, this is your paycheck, congratulations, you don't know when the next one will come. So you might be careful with it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And when it runs out, right? You're like, man, and now I'm dipping into like other savings to live. And so, yeah, I think after that, I wanted some stability. And honestly, if you look at being a financial advisor, I do feel like it's a good mix between kind of, if you take like a corporate job and you take something like being a realtor, right? It's more stable. You still have a lot of the autonomy, right? Of crafting your own schedule, feeling like you're working for yourself, but it is during normal business hours for the most part. You know, the stock market's open in Kansas City, 8:30 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. And so it's normal business hours, but yet there's still kind of that entrepreneurial piece of it. And so I think it was just a great, for me, it was the perfect fit. And it's funny because like as you get older, you know, I'm 47 years old now, and not too far away from being 48 years old. And you start to think about, you know, I've been doing what I'm doing now for over 20 years. And I just think back and I'm like, I just don't know what other job I could have done. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like this job and this career is the perfect fit for me. And I just literally can't imagine having done something else with my career at this point in time. So, or what that would have been.
I love it because when I became a business owner, which is interesting because to your point, I mean, I was an engineer when I left the workforce. So it's not like from the service delivery perspective, it's not like that much changed, right? We're still doing the same thing for other people. Only now I was stressing about invoicing and making sure I got paid and, you know, is it a net 30 or a net 90 and all, you know, all that fun stuff that makes up business. And yet for some reason, I felt like it was as if I had put on a glove I was always meant to wear. It just fit. Yep. Everything about it just fit. The stresses weren't the same kind of stress.
Right.
They were like, I took them on personally. I thoroughly enjoyed that every fault or problem I could take personal ownership for. I had to. I don't know. I think there's maybe other people that somehow don't. But for me, it was like, I don't. What do you mean you don't? You're the owner. It's if there's a problem in the business, that's on you, you know?
Yep.
And I thoroughly enjoyed that, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
And I still enjoy that when you hire on other people, it's like if they're bad eggs, then, I mean, on one hand, nobody's perfect. You can't just read people like a book, unfortunately. On the other hand, you're the one that hired them, right?
Right. That's right. Yeah. So it's like, you're exactly right. It's almost like you kind of have to take a little bit of the blame on yourself in that regard. And I think where you're talking about there, I agree. Like where you got into, the technical support business and everything fit like a glove. And that doesn't mean that there's not a lot of hard work that goes into it. But when you have that passion, when it's something that you love and you have that passion, it's very, very different than anything, than going to a job every day. It's almost a lot. It becomes almost for me more of a lifestyle than it is a career or a job, you know? And I think it's special to find that because I don't think everybody does in their lifetime, you know? And that's cool that you were able to find that. and you know, the, kind of that perfect fit in business. And I feel the same way about, you know, my career as well. I feel very fortunate and have a lot of gratitude for that, for sure.
So to that end, because this feeling now, I'm remembering it, you know, I still feel it, but obviously once you get kind of used to anything, really, what those first clients for me were when they thanked me on top of paying me, it was a weird notion to me because it was like, you don't have to thank me. I'm doing what I said I would do to the best of my ability. And, you know, at first, I think I even told them, like, you don't have to thank me. And then it kind of got awkward me saying that. So I just kind of let it go. But every time they thanked me, it was like this weird feeling of like, why? Why? I mean, I'm glad you're thankful, but why are you thanking me? You're paying me to do and I'm doing it. Right. And so I guess what I'm kind of getting at is even just the work, the pay and the thanks felt deeper and more intimate in some way, for lack of any better word, than, you know, a Friday at five paycheck.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I would say part of that's the fact that the satisfaction, you know, a client saying thank you is probably means that they're, well, I know for me, I'm a technical nightmare. I'm not a good tech guy. Right. And so when I thank my tech guy when he comes on and helps me too, because I'm like, man, I would have been shut down all day, had I not, run in or, you know, got you on the line to kind of fix this stuff. And so I think for you, your role is super, super important in people's lives. You know, because nobody can do anything without their computer. And if your technology is acting up, you're kind of out of business nowadays for the day. Right. And so, it's just a really important, I don't think, you know, it's kind of one of those things that people can't get away without having, unless you're very technologically savvy. I don't think you can get away without having a tech person these days.
Yeah. I'd agree to some end for sure. Thank you, by the way. So, okay, let's get back to you though. So, okay. You're Cisco, more stable paycheck, but also like the Bank of America, it's got you kind of ruminating. And it's interesting because Bank of America, real estate, it's kind of evolving the dream a little bit. And then at Cisco's when you kind of have the peak realization of, I want to get back to, and then the other thing I wanted to circle back on was the, you almost had to do a sales opportunity at home. I had when I transitioned to business, that was another thing that I don't know, nobody talks about. It was a little bit different for me and my wife as well. And I'm fortunate that I had a coach at the time, and she asked it so perfectly, I wouldn't have thought it mattered. She goes, were you a business entrepreneur when you got married, or did you become a business entrepreneur after you got married? And I was like, why does it matter? But after. And she's like, well, why it matters is you basically completely changed the rules of engagement that had been agreed upon well beforehand. And they might have been agreed upon now, but also, you know, it's hard for somebody else to see the roller coaster.
Right. Yep. 100%. And so, that sales job, you know, at home, I don't know if I want to call it a sales job. I guess I'm the one who said that it's a sales job, but it was definitely a little bit of explaining, right? I had to go home and I think that Alyssa had a pretty good idea that I wasn't super content in my job that I had. And the job, by the way, it was unbelievably awesome company and awesome job. The thing for me was just that I was in, it was in the food service business. I didn't feel like I was using my finance degree, which is the way my brain works. Right. And so I just wasn't. And so, and the other sales reps there, a lot of them were chefs. They were people that had been in, the food service business, for a while. And, it was kind of like when I was in construction science in college, kind of looked around the room and I'm like, there's one guy that doesn't look like he, you know, it doesn't seem as engaged as maybe some of the other people. And that was, so it was kind of an awakening for me. And so when I went home after I'd gotten married and I told Alyssa that I think I wanted to go back into financial services, she wasn't putting up a fight or anything, but we had to have the conversation of, hey, you know, I'm making X right now and I'm going to be taking a step back for probably a couple of years. But I think at that point in time, one of the things I saw about financial services or about being a financial advisor is that you have uncapped income. You know what I mean? When you go into that, we always joke in our business that for the first 5 years, you do twice the work for half the money of all your friends. And then 5 years and beyond, you do half the work for twice the money. And that's kind of the joke in the industry. And that's true, is that first 5 years is a complete grind of you just trying to meet people, trying to get them to open an account with you, trying to just build some sort of a book of business, or at least that's how it was back then. The industry changed a little bit since then. But so I took a pretty decent step back financially, and she had to have the faith in me that ultimately I was going to, you know, create a better lifestyle for us by being in financial services. And that did come to fruition, but it didn't happen in the first couple of few years. And so she was patient, and I was super grateful of that. And not only that, she was someone that I had to blow off a lot of steam in those first probably 5 years of just, you know, there's times where you feel like you're not going to make it, or it's not going as well. And it just took a little bit of time to really get a rhythm and to start seeing that this thing was going to work out. So.
Well, and I'm really glad you've brought this up, because it is something I'm sure a lot of other people and entrepreneurs have or are going through. And yet it isn't really something that's talked about a whole lot. So I remember having the same sort of conversation with my wife. And, you know, the logic element when you're still bringing a salary, it's I don't want to say it's easy, but it's, you know, we sit down and I remember saying, okay, honey, it's going to do something like this, you know, and I'm doing a little wavy motion with my hand, right, where the finances are going to dip. We're going to have to pull back a little bit. Then they're going to kind of turn around and all will be gravy, right? And that's the plan on paper. And to your point, you brought it about. I brought it about. You can bring it about. But when you are in that valley, nobody talks about the emotional component of, we can't eat out tonight. Sorry, it's been 3 months since we've had a date night, and we're probably supposed to have one, but I don't know how we swing it, or we're going to put that on the credit card, and oh my goodness, I don't exactly know how we're going to pay it back after the fact, but we need that thing, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I guess what I'm kind of asking was, is it safe to say it was kind of similar? You said she was patient, and I believe that. But then on the same token, it's kind of like there's probably some difficult conversations even then, and some weird choices that you were like, I never thought I'd have to.
Yeah. There was some of that. What I will say is I do feel like the way I came into entrepreneurship was a little bit of a hybrid, right? Because I was with a big insurance company, so I had benefits. I did have a salary. And so it wasn't like our basic needs were met, you know, for sure. In those first few years, we definitely weren't going on great vacations. We weren't doing, you know, going out to fancy dinners and all that stuff. Our basic needs were met, but I still experienced the valleys probably in a different way, right? Because I think a lot of entrepreneurs, to your point, you're wondering if you're going to be able to pay back a credit card or do, you know, something like that. Mine was more of, am I going to make it? Like, is this career going to make it? And because after this salary's gone, which they kind of wean you off of it, is it all going to work out? And so luckily for me, I had gotten, before the salary was gone, I had at least gotten to the level of, you know, our basic needs were going to be met. And, but it was definitely some ups and downs, you know, because I started in 2004, and we did go through 2008, you know, the great financial crisis. That was a long, very long couple of years. And that was certainly a time that I had worked really hard for like 3.5 years to build this thing up. And it kind of got torn down. You know what I mean? When the great financial crisis happened, and it was out of my control, And that was a time where I was, where it was just like one of those where, you know, everybody has these times as someone that's either building your own, you know, sales career or building your own business or whatever it is, when you're kind of trying to eat what you kill, I guess, of like, you know, you wake up and you're like, why am I doing this? And should I just do something else? Should I quit? And there was certainly a number of times in the beginning of my career that I went through this phase of, you know, why am I doing this? I could just go get a corporate job and do that again. And yeah, I'm very, very glad that I stuck with where I'm at, you know, for sure. Like, looking back now, those trials and tribulations were pretty minor. They seemed huge at the time, but they were pretty minor when you really think about it. And when you're kind of looking at the big picture of where you're at today versus what kind of what was going on back during those times. So,
yeah. 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 Well, and they certainly change too. That's cool. So what prompted going independent?
So,
What was that duration? You said they kind of wean you off over, what was it, 3 years?
Well, so going independent, what I meant by that is that that was when I was still at the insurance company. I was there for 7 years, and you only have a salary for the first 3 years. And then you're basically, by that point in time, they kind of wean you off that. And then you're just, kind of making what you make based on your production levels and stuff like that. And then I went independent in 2011. Okay, so that would have been, I guess, 14 years ago. And there was a number of reasons, you know, that I decided to do that. And I think the biggest one was that I just wanted to own my own company. I wanted to kind of feel like I was in charge of, even though in my old setting, I was in charge of, you know, I worked harder, I made more money, I built a bigger client base, so on and so forth. There were some strings attached, you know, in a large insurance environment, a lot of times, or even like a large financial service company, there's a lot of them that have proprietary products, you know, and when you have a proprietary product, a lot of times, like, my benefits were attached to placing a certain amount of proprietary product that the organization made and that sort of thing. So, you know, when we're in the business of helping people and helping clients, but yet there's this alternative motive of like, hey, I got to sell so much of this product or I'm not going to have health insurance. To me, there's an inherent conflict of interest there. And it exists in our business. I don't think our business is the only one that it exists in. When you get into the independent world, you don't have that. You're literally, I would say it was going from working for my clients and a company at the same time to now just working for my clients, which means, you know, I can literally sit down with a client. There is nobody telling me that I have to do anything a certain way, sell a certain product, anything like that. I can look them in the eye with certainty that I'm working in a fiduciary capacity for them. And the only thing in our mind is their best interest. And I felt like when you were working for that larger organization that had some of those sales quotas and proprietary products, it was difficult to do that at times.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, especially in the earlier phases, for sure, right? Where it's like, you know, I got to make my salary. It's a runway. It's an unofficial runway is what it is. And it's,
right.
This plane's got to take off before the end of the runway or we're in trouble.
It's a good way to put it.
If there's a particular package here that's going to get me a little bit closer. Then...
That's right. Either you're going to crash or you're going to take off. One of the two.
Right.
And then once you take off, you got to keep doing, you know, selling a certain amount of this or you're going to crash later on. And so I just wanted that freedom. I felt like it was a liberation to a degree to go independent and just to be able to do. And it was another discussion with Alyssa. I did in the beginning, I took a step back. It didn't take long. In that setting, I had built my client base. I had some avenues I had to go through with my old organization to make sure I was leaving in the right way. And so we did take a step back for a little bit, but it didn't take that long. And then, you know, once I got, I would say my motivation level, once I became independent and it was like, hey, the future is up to me and it's mine here for the taking. I just, my motivation level and my passion only grew. And it grew exponentially during that time, for sure.
So where'd you meet your partner? What prompted that sort of organization in the original?
Yeah. So so Eric was the original. So which partner are you talking about? Are you talking about the one that's no longer here?
That first one.
That first one.
Okay, great. Did you have several then? So you went independent, and we know there were partners involved. Was there multiple or?
Yeah. So there's still, I still have two partners right now. And so.
Right.
They both bought into the business back in 2021. Okay. So I was the sole owner until that time. And then they bought in, for a minority share at that point in time. But, both Eric, who's still a partner in this organization. And then, the partner that was no longer with us, we met because we all went independent around the same time. So Eric came from Bank of America. The other gentleman came from Edward Jones. I came from the Equitable Life Insurance Company, or AXA Equitable. And we all went independent at the same time. And we landed at the same compliance office. It's called V Wealth Management, which is a big RIA, or Registered Investment Advisor. So in our business, you know, you can do one of two things. Is you can join up with a registered investment advisor that's registered with the SEC and basically build under their umbrella. Or you can register directly with the SEC. Well, you've got to get to $100 million of assets before you can register with the SEC. And so typically when you're starting as an independent, you link up with one of these big organizations. We all linked up with that organization at the same time, or similar time period within you know, six, 8 months of each other, and just decided to kind of team up and then started working together in the office of V Wealth Management. And it was 2013, very beginning of 2013 is when we decided to move out of that office and start our own office. And that was when it was named after, you know, our last names. And then we basically decided, after one of the partners left, that we were going to go ahead and rename, to Metcalf Partners. So that was the transition period. And then Eric and I, you know, continue that. Eric was the one that we were like, you know, what are we going to do now? Is it going to be called, you know, the Graham Financial Group, the Graham Wymore Financial Group, or maybe we just don't name it after our names, and let's have a name that can grow, that so that people want to come to work here, you know what I mean, and want to be an advisor here and not worry about whose name's on the front door. And so that's when we came up with Metcalf Partners Wealth Management. And it's funny, that name always gets confused too. People are like, Metcalf Wealth Partners, and we're like, no, it's Metcalf Partners Wealth Management. But I don't know when and why we kind of decided on that particular name, but we did. And then we had a client that I think charged us like $400 to build a logo, which it's on my shirt right now. Like our main logo has a circle around it, but it's Metcalf Partners. We paid next to nothing for that logo, and we've just kept it. And at this point, I don't think we'll probably ever change it for any reason that I can think of. So
there you go. You're like, the rest is history, right?
The rest is history. Yeah. We started growing, and then, you know, Ethan became became an employee back in 2020. So he actually jumped from a big financial services company here in town as well. He had worked there for 5 years and then worked at a couple other ones before that. But the story of how Ethan came to work here is kind of a cool story, because he was in the same fraternity as me at K-State. We were ATOs at K-State, and he was 10 years behind me. And I did not know him at all. And he was, so this was right around the time, this would have been about 2012. So it was right after I jumped from AXA Equitable over to be independent. And he cold called me out of the blue, had never met him before. And he's like, hey, I have an internship with Edward Jones. I'm looking for a job after school. Our old chapter advisor named Bill Muir had given him my name as somebody that's in this business, someone to talk to in Kansas City. And so, anyway, he just cold called me and came in and was like, hey, I'm looking for a job after school. And I was like, well, I literally just started this thing, just jumped over, and there's no way I can pay somebody a salary to come to work here right now. I'm still trying to just get my own ship moving in the right direction. Right. And so, years go by. So he ends up taking another job and then goes to work for a big company here in town. And this would have been in 2020, so almost 10 years later, right? I guess that'd be 9 years later, or whatever it was. In 2020, I posted a job on LinkedIn that I was looking for a junior advisor and someone to come in and kind of help grow grow my book of business while I was, you know, let me focus on kind of the bigger aspects of the business and then help with a lot of the service work on the business. And he pinged me on LinkedIn and was like, hey, are you still hiring for this? I'd like to visit with you about it. So we went out and coffee and figured out that it was a fit. And he was making, you know, we ended up, you know, hiring him for as a higher level job than a junior advisor, because he had, you know, he was at that spot in the business. So I was paying him a lot more than what I had intended to pay for that position. But he came to work with us to, you know, almost 8 years after the initial interview. And he literally got here in February of 2020, and then COVID happened. So he started in February, COVID happened, we were all at home. And, so anyway, he was working from home, we were communicating, but Ethan is, I mean, he is a blessing to have in our organization, such a hard worker. And it was really, it became apparent pretty quickly that I wanted him to be a partner in the organization, so that he was committed to the long term of the organization, and that he saw himself a future as an owner in this organization. So it was really only, you know, less than 2 years after he started that he bought in as a partner of the organization. And, you know, since then he's obviously become an advisor. He's a great financial advisor and a great, you know, he's a good producer. He's a good networker, and he finds a lot of good new business and stuff like that. So he's definitely grown out of that. What we hired him for would be that junior advisor role, and is hitting on all cylinders as an advisor. And it's been fun to watch. And I always laugh, like when I look at the folks that we have here in the office, which I have absolutely fantastic people in this office, and they've all kind of come to me, like fallen in my lap, and to a degree, if that makes sense. It's like Eric was one that we just kind of teamed up when we both landed at VWealth, and then Ethan kind of fell in my lap, you know, as far as like cold calling me, and then reaching back out after I posted that job on LinkedIn. And then Andy Voss, who's our COO and head trader, he's one. I'm a big pickleball player. I play a lot of golf and I play a lot of pickleball. He plays pickleball at a higher level than me because he gets to play a lot more. But I do play in similar circles, and he plays with my younger brother a lot. Because my younger brother's a very committed and good pickleball player. And anyway, so I was playing with him one day, and he's like, hey, and he worked at a big company here. I mean, great experience in the industry. And we got done playing, and he's like, hey, are you hiring at your place? And in his role, he was at a large organization that had a head trader, you know, that basically has thousands and thousands of financial advisors. And for that organization, they had a head trader, and then they had five trading managers, and then whatever it was, like 50 traders that reported up. So each one of them, and he was one of the five trading managers. He'd been there for 6 years, had amazing experience in the business. And he was just kind of ready to get out of that corporate world. And so he just asked me, he's like, you got any room? And it was right around the time that we were looking to kind of expand and hire someone to run the office and to do do all of the trading of our portfolios. And so the timing was kind of impeccable, but it was another one that like kind of approached me, and it just kind of fell in my lap. And then, you know, our latest hire, who's Lynn Henderson, who's our, you know, works at the front desk. She's an administrative assistant, but she's one that, that we found on LinkedIn as well, posted a job. She literally, the day before we posted that job, was working for a big financial services firm, had been for 6 years, in the same role, and kind of decided that she wanted to get out of the big corporate and move to small business world. And just happened to apply for it. And we're like, man, it's somehow the best people that we've got have kind of come in my mind, somewhat luckily, and it's kind of like put ourselves in the right place to find the right people. But it's just a fun environment right now. I've never had more fun at work than we're having right now, because no matter where I walk in the organization, I want to talk to the person that I see, which is a cool place to be, you know? So.
Well, and it's cool to see you light up about it. If I had to guess, that's probably a pretty good indicator as to
there you go.
As to where they come from a little bit with regards to falling in your lap to some end.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's cool. I like that. That's cool.
Yep.
I did have a question and I'm curious about it, but I'm also, I want to be conscious. We could get it up on a whole different tangent. It seems like there are these industries, and financial advisement, I think, is kind of one of them, where there's it. You see a lot more partners. You see a lot more percentage partners. Not that there's not plenty of businesses that do that, but it's interesting because part of the reason I ask is, like, attorneys, for example, they have this whole partnership structure, right, that really kind of varies depending on the firm that you go to. And then I'm sure they have some boilerplate options. What are some ways that partnership typically happens from a logistical perspective in advisement firms? And that's more for, you know, you imagine somebody listening right now, there may be a green advisor. What are some things they should be looking out for, some potential opportunities for them maybe in the future?
Yeah. So I think if I'm understanding correctly, you're kind of wondering what are the different structures, you know, that people put in place to run a firm. And there's quite a few of them. But I would say the two main would be, like, if you think about some of the larger firms around Kansas City, they might be, they've got, you know, one person that's like the main advisor. And then they build this firm around them to where maybe they're the face of the organization, right? But they've got a lot of advisors that are working, that have their own books of business within there. But I'd say one of the keys, and I'll tell you our structure, is that for Eric and Ethan and I, and we are actively starting to seek some additional advisors. And I know one of the things I didn't talk to you about earlier, and I'm sorry to go off on this tangent, but like when I think about Metcalf Partners, and one thing I didn't mention is one thing, a huge development that we had, and the reason that I decided to hire Ethan back in 2020 was because I had purchased the book of business from a retiring advisor in 2019, which was a really big moment for Metcalf Partners because we grew drastically in size at that point in time. We grew by over 50% of what we were. So at the time of that in 2019, we were about $100 million is what we were managing at the time. And then when we absorbed Greg Bond's book of business, he was managing about $65 million. So it was we went from 100 million to 165 million and it grew our revenue by whatever that is, 60% kind of overnight. And that transaction, you know, if you have all the transactions in the world, so that was the third book of business that I had bought at that point in time. I had bought a couple of other smaller ones. Back in 2016, it was kind of a funny story how I met Greg and how this whole thing happened. Not a funny story. It's actually a sad story. But it's a wild story. It was a sad story that was also pivotal in my career and in Metcalf Partners' growth. It was that back in 2016, I had decided that I wanted to take the road of trying to buy financial services practices, and so I got a list. I met up with a business broker, and they scrubbed a list of financial advisors, independent financial advisors that were over a certain age in the Kansas City area. And I just wrote a letter and started sending out letters every quarter to this same group of people. Hey, I'm looking to acquire practices. If you're interested in selling, you know, here's my contact information. And I get a call one day, and it was a gentleman named Eric Engstrom. And he asked me if I'd go to lunch. He was thinking about selling his business. And lo and behold, we get to lunch. We talk about it. His was a smaller book of business. It was about a $10 million book of business. And he said, hey, basically, after the lunch, he was like, I'm going to tell you something. He said, I actually was just diagnosed with lung cancer. I think they've told me I have somewhere between 6 months and a year to live, and I need someone to take over my practice, and it needs to be a pretty quick transaction. And I said, well, I will do that with you. So it was a crazy time because he came to work with us. I bought his book of business, and he lived for about a year and a half after that. And for the first 7 months of that, him and I were going around meeting all the clients. He was introducing, you know, me to them. And so that was that initial book of business. And he was so fun to work with. He was, even though he was sick, he had the best attitude, and he was a ton of fun to be around. And then toward the end of it, he said, hey, I've got, you know, because he was in an office with two other advisors when he sold to me, but they were older advisors around his age. Obviously weren't interested in buying his book of business, and he wasn't really interested in selling it to them. And he said, hey, I've got another guy named Greg Bond that I've been, you know, officing with for a number of years. And he's, you know, he's about to be retirement age as well. And so he introduced me to Greg, and Greg had the 60, you know, he had a $10 million book of business. Greg had the $65 million book of business. So then it was 3 years later that I bought Greg's book of business. But again, that's another one of those things that, you know, Greg, even though I made the efforts to send out the letter, you know, ended up getting to Eric Engstrom. He called me, he introduced me to Greg. And that was like a huge growth time that started from that sad scenario of Eric Engstrom, you know, having cancer and having to sell his book of business. And his wife, Gay, is still a client. I still talk to her all the time. She's one of my most vocal clients. She calls in, you know, probably once a month, and I get to talk to her. She lives down in Florida now. But anyway, so that was a big part of Metcalf Partners over the years. And back to your question, because I just went on a huge tangent, but back to your question about how...
No, it was a good tangent. We could completely change topics if you wanted to, because that is one of the more, I think, interesting and, or for lack of any better terms, beautiful things about business is it's never just business, right? I mean, Eric wasn't just, I need to sell my book and it needs to be a fast transaction, although that was pivotal. Eric was also, you know, you correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't spend 6 months of the time that you have left introducing somebody to every client and continue to serve their wife afterwards if they don't have some degree of a relationship and trust built with you in a relatively short amount of time. And that's what I think sometimes is missed on the outside looking in on business, which is we're all people. Most of us are trying to do our damnedest to be decent at being people.
Yep, absolutely. And that was, that was a wild just time. The whole thing was kind of surreal, you know, because we even had the conversation in the car one time. We'd gone downtown. He was going to introduce me to one of his clients that lived in the Northland, and we met him downtown, had some dinner. And he was driving back and he's like, this is kind of wild because this is, he said, this is for you in business. This is an exciting time, right? And for me, this is a really hard and sad time. And it's like, it was a really surreal, because it was a real conversation that I was having with someone that I had just met, that we were doing this transition and he was going to pass away and he knew it. And it was just like it was pretty surreal time, you know, just conversation of like, yeah, I know that this person is going to pass away. By the end of that 6 months, I loved Eric Engstrom, and I think he felt the same way about me too. And yeah, so it was wild, but it's funny how that stuff works out. And then for him to have introduced us to Greg as well, which Greg, you know, him and Greg couldn't have been more opposite individuals, right? Greg's super hard charger, you know, and he's one of those guys that like he walks into an office and he can change the whole dynamic of it, right? Because he's got a strong personality, he's a smart guy. Eric was a super easygoing, kind of a sweet guy. And so anyway, it was crazy. But I did want to circle back, because I was gonna, how I went on that tangent is you asked about how people structure offices. And so Eric and Greg, and they had another partner named Dick. So they were simply partners in overhead expenses, right? So they each ran their own book of business, but they all kind of branded together and they all just shared the expenses of the administrative staff and of the office and all that stuff. And then, you know, you can also have it. So they just completely ran their own books of business. If you looked at the investment selection of each of their client bases, they'd be completely different. You know, where I run my office and how we run our office is it is a centralized firm, right? Meaning if you look at any of Ethan's clients, Eric's clients, my clients, they're the firm's clients, not our individuals. We're the service advisors for those clients, but we have models and they all have the same investments and we're all telling the same story with all the clients that we're meeting with, and we all have the same strategy and we're doing the same thing. So we're all completely on the same page. you know, as opposed to an overhead sharing agreement, it's actually a partnership in how we run the firm and how we deal with our clients. And then, you know, you have the other firms that maybe are some of those bigger firms that really the it's even more integrated than what I am, where it's like there's one person running all the money, and basically the advisors are simply sales reps, you know. So there's a number of different ways that people can do it, but when you look in the independent space, there's a lot of that where you go into an office and there's just five different guys doing five different things, but they're just sharing an administrative assistant and they're sharing the overhead expenses there. So there's a number of different ways that people do it, but I love how we do it because I think it makes it, number one is we all can bounce things off of each other, right? We have an investment committee. I'm on the investment committee. Eric's on the investment committee. Ethan's on the investment committee. Andy's on it. And then we have an outside chief investment officer out of South Carolina that we pay as a contractor that's on our investment committee that sits in and kind of gives us advice. And so it's just real easy when we're all sitting in meetings together. I think if Ethan were to meet with one of my clients, you know, that he doesn't know very well, it would be a very similar experience to them meeting with me and vice versa. And I think that's important. And it's really good for longevity of the business. And I think for succession of the business, you know, if I get hit by a bus, you know, it's my client's experience isn't going to change that much for them. So
that's cool. Well, thank you. Thank you. That helps. Yep. With that. Yeah. Cool. Well, before we begin to wrap up, is there anything we kind of missed that you can think of that you wanted to tackle?
I don't think so. I mean, I really appreciate a lot of having me on here. This is fun. Yeah. You know, it's not every day that somebody actually talks to you and listens, hears your own story. And I really appreciate you do a really good job at that. And I appreciate it because it's fun. It's fun to do. And I know you and I were talking about it because we have a podcast now too. It's Metcalf Money Moment podcast. And we have guests on, and it's a great way to just learn about people. It's fun to have someone on your podcast and learn different stuff. And this is the first time, just so you know, that I've ever been on somebody else's podcast, and I certainly appreciate the invite. So yeah.
All right. It's a fun way too of, and maybe it's just me, but I don't think so. It feels we can meet together in this moment, but also I feel like I'm being productive at the same time. Even though if you were to just ask me, it's like I'm just meeting with Jeb and enjoying the moment.
Yeah.
So we have two questions we wrap up with here.
Okay.
So we have a motto that says, if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant in your life that's empowered you to see further that you'd like to pay homage to in this moment?
Okay. There's a few of them. You know, there's... As far as standing, I'd say when I went to the independent world, there's a guy that I went to college with. It's funny. So Ethan was a fraternity brother of mine, 10 years younger. Well, the guy that got me into V Wealth Management was a fraternity brother of mine, 2 years older. So I knew him. He was really good buddies with my older brother, and I knew him in college, but, his name's Dan Chera. And so he was, when I was wanting to go independent, he was a guy that was going through transition as well. He worked for another guy, and the guys at V Wealth bought his old boss's book of business. And so he landed at V Wealth right when him and I were already talking about maybe trying to jump in together, somewhere. And so he introduced me to a guy named Tom Bloomer and another guy named Brett Lang who eventually Dan, Tom, and Brett became the owners of V Wealth Management, which was the RIA at the time, which is not, doesn't exist anymore because they sold the compliance piece of it away. But those guys, I will tell you, to this day, because they sold the compliance office and we're still, so they now report to the same compliance office with their practice as I do with my practice. And we still talk all the time. And I think through the years, you know, those guys, I would have to give a lot of credit to, number one, creating the environment when I got to V Wealth Management that I felt like I was, even though I kind of worked for them and I had my own company, but they were kind of my mentors and my compliance guys and all that. And I think they really created an environment that I was able to thrive in. And I think they knew that. And I think I certainly owe those guys a lot for where I'm at now. And then, you know, in that prior life at AXA, Equitable, I had another boss that had an interest in me. His name is Doug Propack. And so when I started there, he was one that promoted me into a managerial role. And I will say he's one that there's still some things like in career. I remember one time I walked into his office and I was super, super like mad. I can't remember what it was. It was like a Friday. I had a bad week and I was kind of running hot. And I was like, I was just amped up and he could tell. And he kind of gave me this, you know, hey, this too shall pass type of speech. And I still remember that sometimes when I get all juiced up on or fired up on stuff, I remember it was kind of a voice of reason at that point in time. And, you know, when I left that organization and started my own, it wasn't a super, you know, cordial split. And I've since seen him and met up you know, I think for him, for sure, I think the farther I got away from AXA Advisors and into my independent role, the more appreciation, that I had for what that organization did for me. And I think it took me a couple of years to come to that conclusion or maybe see it. So he would be one as well.
So that may lead into the second question, which is if there was any sort of like guiding principle or maybe even pithy saying that you found to be true again and again and again, what would that be?
So will you say that one more time? A guiding state.
Like a guiding principle or pithy saying that you found to be true again and again and again. So like this too shall pass, right? Is that something
you're thinking of that. And I know what's funny is I have probably 100 of them. And now that you ask me, I can't think of a single one of them off the top of my head. So I might have to think on that one for a minute, but,
that's good. I can definitely,
you,
can,
you know, I feel like that's one that I want to have and I can't think of it right now. So it's a guiding principle or a guiding saying.
Pithy saying. Something your dad told you and it stuck with you, or one of your many mentors told you and stuck with you.
You know, that's another thing. If we go back, so do you edit and cut this, by the way, or what's your, does the whole thing?
We can edit this a little bit if you want to, but it doesn't, we don't typically edit it. Like if you'll let me, I'll let this ride.
I think when you go back to monsters that, you know, I was talking about my industry, you know, I was talking about Tom and Brett, Dan and Doug.
Yep.
And I think for sure I'd have to pay a lot of tribute, just to my dad as well. Both my parents.
Okay.
And when it comes to business, my dad was a phenomenal business person, had a huge job. He was, president, CEO, Sysco Food Services, Kansas City for a number of years. And then, he worked for their corporate office as, basically he was the boss of a lot of the local, CEOs, like what his old job was prior to that. And he's a guy that has a lot of wisdom. And to this day, I have clients, you know, that are clients of mine because I met through him and Sysco. And it's funny. I see someone that used to work for him. Anywhere I see him in the city, the first thing they want to know is how's my dad doing? And they talk to me for a couple of minutes about what he did for them or, you know, their experience working with him. And so he's certainly, you know, a mentor and someone that I would have to pay heed to as well. So,
okay.
That saying, you know what, I'm going to have to get back to you on that one. How's that? Cause I've got a million, it's kind of like, you know, it's funny.
Yeah.
My wife and I and friends, we play this game around the fire where we pass the phone and play songs, you know, so basically I'll play a song and then I pass it and someone plays the next song and da, 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 da. And we always say, it's like, I have a billion songs that I like, but the second that phone hits my hand, I can't think of a single one of them. And I think that's what I'm relating this to. It's like, there's a lot of
stuff. No, hey, it's okay. Yeah. I mean, it works out great. Cause especially it's funny. I asked the question and I do want to hear the answer. That's why I asked the question. But on the same token, I read a book that radically changed my opinion about pithy sayings called Business Secrets from the Bible. And he lines up all these pithy sayings back to back. And you start to realize how ludicrous they are and how much more life just isn't that black and white. And he would say, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder, right? This is a pithy one that we know. But then also out of sight, out of mind. So yeah. Which is it, right? You know, right. I mean, these are pithy sayings that we're gambling
other,
our
right?
entire relationship on in some cases because somebody said it and it sounds cool. But also, there's just so much more involved in a relationship yeah. than those two pithy sayings.
Yep, no doubt.
But anyway, thank you so much for being on, Jeb. It's been a yep. pleasure having you.
Sam, thanks for having me on. It's been a lot of fun. And this hour and I guess almost a half now flew by. Went by quick. So
sure did. Thank you, everybody.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.